So, without further ado, we are continuing a series of studies on the historical context of the Bible. You know that in our first several weeks, we've been focusing on that region of the world, which is often called the cradle of civilization, Mesopotamia, the earliest records, the earliest evidence that we've come across in historical investigation of a kind of organized civilization seems to be rooted there in southern Mesopotamia and a region called Sumer. And so that's where we started our conversation, and we're sort of working our way through. This will be the last week that we'll be zeroing in on Mesopotamia itself. So next week, Lord willing, we're going to shift our focus to Egypt, and we'll spend two or three weeks looking at the, again, historical background of Egypt and how it intersects with biblical history along the way. But we have looked at Mesopotamian civilization, noting that there's a series of dynasties, and this is the way it's usually organized. So the earliest of these is called Sumer, goes down to about 2300. After that was Akkad, or the Akkadian dynasty, founded by Sargon, goes to about 2200. And then Ur, which brings us down to about 2000. And of course, Abraham is said to be from Ur of the Chaldees. So we have what appears to be the birthplace of Abraham. He was born apparently just after that dynasty had reached its conclusion and Mesopotamia had descended into a kind of decentralized governance. There was no one dominating authority, but rather there were several. The chief in the south was called Isin, I-S-I-N. In the north, it was Eshnunna. And Abraham seems to have been born in the context of that more or less decentralized or so-called intermediate period. The last dynasty we're interested in with respect to Mesopotamia is called the Old Babylonian. And that's what we're going to look at today. The most famous king of the Old Babylonian era is a guy by the name of Hammurabi. Babylon had two great eras, Old Babylon and what's called Neo-Babylon. Neo-Babylon produced the great king Nebuchadnezzar. We'll look at him in some detail at a later time, but right now we're focused on that earlier era, the Old Babylonian period, and so that will occupy our attention this morning. The biblical text that I'd like to refer you to as a kind of backdrop for our conversation this morning is found in Exodus chapter 19. So if you'd like to turn there, I want you to have this text in the back of your mind as we proceed through the conversation, because I think if anything, it helps us set in contrast the best of what we find in Hammurabi compared with this rather remarkable moment that's described for us in the biblical description of Israel entering into a covenant relationship with the God of Israel. So Exodus chapter 19, you know the setting here, I suppose. The children of Israel have been liberated from Egypt. The 10 plagues, if you were in the studies of Exodus last year, you recall all of this. They've come across the Red Sea. They've marched, in a sense, from that point to Mount Horeb, otherwise known as Sinai, probably located in Saudi Arabia today, or Midian in the ancient world. And it's here that now God, who has rescued them, proposes to them. There is a kind of marital sort of backdrop to this whole thing. God proposes to be their covenant Lord, their covenant husband, which is exactly the way he styles himself through much of the Old Testament, especially prophetic literature. This is where I betrothed you. This is where I married you, you see. God proposes to these people. If they say yes, their marriage vows will be the Ten Commandments, to which they will give their amen and embrace this relationship. God promises to care for them. They promise to obey him. And off we go in a covenant connection between God and his people. And this text we're looking at this morning is the preamble to the giving of the Ten Commandments. So this is Exodus chapter 19, beginning at verse 16. Hang on a second. This shouldn't be so difficult, I know. One step at a time. There. Exodus 19, beginning at verse 16, the Word of God. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning, as well as a thick cloud on the mountain, and a blast of a trumpet so loud that all the people who were in the camp trembled. Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God. They took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended upon it in fire. The smoke went up like the smoke of a kiln while the whole mountain shook violently. As the blast of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses would speak and God would answer him in thunder. When the Lord descended upon Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, the Lord summoned Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go down and warn the people not to break through to the Lord to look, otherwise many of them will perish. Even the priests who approach the Lord must consecrate themselves, or the Lord will break out against them." Moses said to the Lord, "The people are not permitted to come up to Mount Sinai, for you yourself warned us, saying, 'Set limits around the mountain and keep it holy.'" The Lord said to him, "Go down and come up bringing Aaron with you, but do not let either the priests or the people break through to come up to the Lord, otherwise he will break out against them." So Moses went down to the people and told them. So that's the text. Keep that in your minds now as we talk a little bit about Hammurabi, but let's just have a word of prayer and we'll get underway. Our Father, we are grateful to you for your many constant mercies toward us. We thank you that day by day we see the evidence of your grace. We see it in the wonder of nature. We see it in the wonder of our own lives and the drama that you work out in the details for each of us of those things that we experience day by day. We thank you that part of that drama began so many years ago and that we can count ourselves part of an ongoing story in which you have called a people to yourself and we can count ourselves among that number. We pray that our consideration of this historical chapter and its significance for biblical history would be helpful to each of us, giving you thanks for it in the name of Christ. Amen. All right, well, we have, I hope I can see this for, I'm not quite getting the same thing you are here. We are to the fifth of the dynasties now that are connected with Mesopotamia, and this is called Old Babylon. And so this is where we want to focus our attention for a few minutes this morning. It was founded about 1894 by a group of people who were known as the Amorites. Amorites represented a tribal group. We hear of them in the Old Testament. You recognize their name because they pop up occasionally, usually as part of the Canaanite population, with a list of ites, you know, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the so on, and you know all of those that tend to be delineated there. Well, one of the major groups that makes it to that list are the Amorites. The Amorites were far flung, and we have quite a bit of information about them from sources outside the Bible. They're sometimes called the Amuru or other names, but clearly it's referring to the same group. They were viewed from the point of view of people in Mesopotamia as rather rude and backwards. They were probably viewed about the way that ancient Romans tended to view the barbarians: threatening, violent, scary, but not very advanced. And that's kind of the way the civilized people of Mesopotamia tended to view these who were called the Amorites. But the Amorites did insinuate themselves into Mesopotamia and began during this intermediate period that we're describing, which there was no centralized authority. they tended to just sort of show up here and there, and many times they were willing to take the more lower class, if I can put it that way, type jobs, jobs that nobody else wanted, and they gradually began to become more and more of a prominent fixture in Mesopotamian life. There was always a sense of a difference between native Chaldeans, who had lived there, of course, for generations, and these relative newcomers who were finding their way in, who were known as the Amorites. But nevertheless, as they came, they began to move into certain villages, but they established a few communities of their own, and one of these was called Babylon. So Babylon is a city that was actually founded by the Amorites, and it is today not much to see. But that's a photograph that was taken of the ruins of Babylon in 1932. It looks like rubble. Those kind of wall structures you're seeing there are actually pretty good sized. If there were a human being there, you'd see that they actually reach up quite a bit over a person's head. But it would be very clear from visiting that site that it was once a great civilized area. It's been rebuilt considerably. So that today, in 2003, it would look something more like this. And you can tell that once again, the refurbishing of it has been fairly significant. This is a shot, these are US Marines, of course, in the front there, and it was part of our occupation for a while of Iraq. And Babylon is located along the Euphrates there in central Iraq. It kind of made press a few years ago because when Saddam Hussein was still with us, he was threatening to go down and rebuild Babylon. You may recall that. And he was actually going to style himself as the next great Nebuchadnezzar. Anybody remember that? And people who are interested in end of the world stuff were getting all juiced up about Saddam Hussein being the Antichrist and so on. I guess it didn't work out that way. But nevertheless, Babylon is a known site, and that's what it looks like. The greatest ruler of this region was known as Hammurabi. There were a series of minor rulers who, more or less, these Amorite rulers set up life in Babylon, but the first one who really comes along to make a name for himself in some way that reaches outside the bounds of that city-state was Hammurabi. He was... There we are. I don't know if you can see that very well. He was, I was about to say a good-looking guy, but you really can't tell much from that, can you? This is a sculpted head, allegedly, of Hammurabi. At least that's probably our best guess. That's presently located at the Louvre in Paris. And there's been quite a few similar artifacts that have been uncovered along the way, and it seems that this is probably the character that we're dealing with here. He wrote his famous code. Okay, let's see. What I'm seeing here is not what I'm seeing there, so that's why I'm acting a little confused. Hammurabi began his reign in 1792, so it's about 100 years after the founding of this city that Hammurabi comes along. When he comes to the rule in Babylon, he's just another of these kind of minor rulers. Babylon has been ruled by several along the way. About the time that he becomes the ruler, if we're trying to orient ourselves to what's going on in biblical history, this would be about the time of the birth of Jacob and Esau. They were born in 1791, about the time that Hammurabi became king. Jacob and Esau, of course, you know, are the sons of Isaac, who was the son of Abraham. And so we're right in the middle of what's called the patriarchal period. So the rule of Hammurabi is taking place in Mesopotamia about the time that we have the patriarchs on the scene in Canaan. Abraham may still be alive. The Bible says he lived to be 175 years old. If that's the case, then he would have still been alive at this time. But of course, he was getting up there by this point as well. So Jacob and Esau are born about this time. Initially, when Hammurabi takes control of Babylon as the next ruler in this line of rulers, he's a relatively minor king surrounded by much greater powers. And it wouldn't appear, you wouldn't think on the face of it, that there was any likelihood that he was going to become some kind of major character that we'd be talking about 3,000 years later. But nevertheless, he was a very bright guy, and he had designs that he seems to have been planning and implementing from a very early period in his career as a ruler. The first of which had to do with the publication of his rather famous code. And so if you've heard of Hammurabi at all, then what you've probably heard of is the Code of Hammurabi. Hammurabi's code was published about 5 years into his reign. He seems to have been enlightened in this sense, that he knew that the possibility of growth and stability and order in a community depended in some significant measure on a sense that people would have of a kind of predictability about the law. It was common at the time for the king to simply be the rule. Whatever the king said was the way it was, and that would always give rise to a certain degree of anxiety and instability and unpredictability, depending on what mood the king happened to be in. Hammurabi had some idea that it's good for people to be able to rely on fixed principles, and we would say that's a fairly enlightened attitude. And he seems to have wanted to communicate that thought to his people early on. And so he publishes this code for which he's become famous, and we'll go back in a few minutes and take a closer look at that. About 20 years into his reign, he begins with a rather surgical precision to expand. And so picking out the weakest of his neighboring colleague rulers, he attacks and conquers. And he does it in a way that just gradually develops increasing power and expanse until finally, by the time he is finished with this campaign of expansion, he has developed an empire which is pretty expansive in its size. So you can see, looking at this, if you can see it right in the darker colored area in the middle there is Babylon, its immediate regions, and then it extends all the way down to the Persian Gulf and up past Mari all the way to or nearly to Quran. And so Hammurabi really does, by the time he's finished, dominate all of Mesopotamia. The only ruler that had a larger empire than Hammurabi was Sargon, who we looked at back with the Akkadian dynasty. So he's quite effective not only in empire building, but also in his understanding of law and how it should work out in the life of his people. Hammurabi died in the year 1750. As is often the case, he didn't have a real great plan for succession. His sons were not nearly as competent as he was, and over the next several years, 100 years or so, the empire survived, but it kept sort of shrinking based on forces nibbling away at the external borders of it until finally by the end of this imperial period, Babylon had shrunk considerably. So he really is the guy that brings it to its highest and most impressive expanse. Babylon fell in a surprise attack by the Hittites in 1595. So that's the end of old Babylon. That's kind of the quick historical sketch. The Hittites were up in what's called Anatolia, otherwise known as Turkey. They came down in a very swift attack and just sacked Babylon, but they didn't care about staying around, so they just took some good stuff, went home, left a vacuum, and the group that came in that vacuum were a group called the Kassites, and I'll save any comment about them for a little bit later. But that's the basic sketch of old Babylon. So probably more than you wanted to know on the subject, but there we are. The code for which Hammurabi is famous was inscribed on a stone stele, as it's called. That thing is about 8 feet tall. And again, if anyone ever seen it, it's in the Louvre. Has anyone ever seen it up close and personal? I never have. But it's a pretty good size unit. And this thing was it was the discovery of this that gave rise to our understanding of what's called Hammurabi's code. It was intended to be displayed publicly. So as I say, about 5 years into his reign, this big monument was placed out apparently right in the city square. Most of these Mesopotamian cities were organized around a center square, which usually had a religious character to it. If there was a ziggurat in the town, which there certainly was in Babylon, that's where you would find it. And it appears that this monument was right out in front. So interestingly, Hammurabi wants to tie this code that he's published now to his people in Babylon to some sort of divine source. And it has a kind of quasi-religious aspect to it, even though for the most part it represents rather practical law and practical principles by which people would govern their lives. It was the first really clear example in ancient, you know, legislative history or jurisprudence of the development of what's called in civil theory lex rex, the law is the king, or what we sometimes call the rule of law. It was not well known in the ancient world. This is why Hammurabi deserves some credit. You know, this was a rather surprising and enlightened development for him to come upon and begin to make an organizational principle of his rule. But nevertheless, it does seem to represent something of a novelty in that sense. This particular monument here, this stele, was plundered by the Elamites. We hear of the Elamites in the Bible. They were to the east of Babylon. It's a region that eventually became known as Persia and today is called Iran. And these people came across at a certain point after the reign of Hammurabi, before the end of the Babylonian dynasty, and they plundered some of the goods from Babylon and they took this back home with them, threw it on the back of an ox cart, you know, and take it back to Elam, where it got lost, buried in the sands of time, as it were, until it was discovered in 1901 by some French archaeologists who immediately recognized its importance, and they grabbed it and took it to Paris, and it's been there since then. So it's currently in France, and it was quite a sensation when it was discovered in 1901 because it was immediately recognized by those people who are familiar with these issues that at least on the face of it, there seemed to be some correlation between Hammurabi's code on the one hand and the code that comes later through Moses on the other. And of course, critical scholars immediately jumped on that and said, oh, we knew it all along. Moses just borrowed from Hammurabi all of his stuff, and this is not divine revelation at all. You know, that kind of thing that sometimes people will seize upon as a reason to doubt the trustworthiness of the scriptures. So anyway, that has made Hammurabi's code something of an interesting question for Old Testament scholars and ancient historians who are concerned about this. Well, the organization of Hammurabi's code is basically 282 separate laws. They're written on 12 tablets, which are inscribed. This is a kind of a close-up of what they would look like, if anyone can make that out. That's a cuneiform once again. But it's 282 separate laws written in Akkadian, which was the language of the day. It was intended to be read. It was intended to sort of publish then the rules by which people could organize their lives and so on. The code tends to be, we'll see some examples of it in a minute, very specific. Each offense that is mentioned receives a particular punishment. Sometimes these punishments are quite severe. By modern standards, there are many capital offenses, as we'll see in a minute. There are many offenses that would result in some kind of disfigurement. But one of the most dramatic aspects of the Code of Hammurabi was the use of what's called the Lex Talionis. The Lex Talionis literally means the law of the eye. It's also the root of our word retaliation, and the popular expression of it is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And so the first expression we ever have in history of that rule, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, of course, we find in Hammurabi's code. That is probably the most dramatic correlation between Hammurabi on the one hand and Moses later, who of course uses the same formula, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, the Lex Talionis. I don't want to be overly subtle at this point, but I do think, in fairness, one could say that when you see the Lex Talionis in Hammurabi's usage of it, it tends to be conceived of as something that would be applied with a certain degree of vigorous literal force, an eye for an eye. Many Old Testament scholars have looked at the use of that term in Moses and said this is functioning has a somewhat different function in Moses' use of it, that it's not expected so much to be implemented in a sort of literal way. It's actually a principle of restraint, as if in Moses it's saying you cannot punish a person for a crime to a degree that is disproportionately severe based on the crime that itself was. It's only an eye for an eye, in other words, not a life for an eye, that kind of thing. Whereas in Hammurabi's use of it, that sense of restraint is not quite so clear. Now, again, that would be a debated point, and I'm just suggesting a perspective on that. But it is, at least on the face of it, interesting that we have both of them using this same code, or this same rule. At the very top of the stele that I was just pointing out, there is this carving, which you probably noticed. And if you can see that, on the left of it there, that would be Hammurabi. And Hammurabi is in front of a seated character, and that seated character is Shamash, who is the sun god of the Sumerians and was a god that was, of course, well known throughout Mesopotamian history. The concept is that, of course, Hammurabi is receiving this code from the sun god, who was associated with law and is responsible, therefore, to carry it down and promulgate it among the people. And so that's the picture. Hammurabi gets it from God or from the gods and gives it to the people. That, again, has some similarity to the biblical understanding. Moses went up on the mountain. He received the law from God, the Ten Commandments, inscribed by God, as you know, and promulgates them to the people. That's not unique to those two. We find a similar idea in Solon of Athens, in Lycurgus of Sparta, in Numa of Rome, and others, where you have this notion of the law is actually given by the gods and is entrusted through one particular person to the people for their good. And so there's nothing unique about this, and I don't suppose you'd be too surprised that we find the biblical narrative suggesting something like that. Those are points of similarity. I think there's some points of significant difference, but nevertheless, we should at least acknowledge that those are points where you can see something that appears to be a similar kind of idea. The parallels have been noted, as I'm saying, but I think we also need, in fairness, to recognize that there have been considerable differences between the one rule and the other. I think it would be safe to say that today there is less certainty, to say the least, about the idea of Moses borrowing from Hammurabi than there was in earlier years. In other words, I think contemporary ancient Near Eastern scholarship doubts with a lot more vigor than it once did the extent to which Moses depended on Hammurabi. Typical of this would be, this is just one of, I think, a representative quote, but certainly we could find other examples of this. This is Dr. G.A. Barton, who's at University of Pennsylvania. This is quite a recent book, published in 2009. It's quite a good book. And so if you're interested in looking at this in greater depth, I would recommend it to you. He's not writing from a Christian perspective at all. I have no idea what his personal faith commitments might be. He's simply a technical scholar of ancient Semitic languages, and he writes on this subject of the connection between Moses and Hammurabi and says, the two laws that anyone who would study the two in their entirety would, he says, be convinced, the student would be convinced that the laws of the Old Testament are in no essential way dependent upon the Babylonian laws. He says that such resemblances arose from a similarity of antecedents of general intellectual outlook, but that there are the striking differences show that there was no direct borrowing by Moses from Hammurabi. And I think this is a representative opinion among scholars who look at these subjects today. So if that's ever been a major concern to you, I think you can rest with some degree of assurance on the supposition that Moses does something quite unique, quite unprecedented, and that whatever slim connections there may be, they are greatly outweighed by the stunning differences between what we find through Moses and what may have come in earlier records through Hammurabi or anyone else. Let me just read for you briefly a little bit of the preamble from Hammurabi's code. This is a lengthy preamble, and this is only the first of about a half a dozen paragraphs, so it goes on at some length, but I just want you to think about what you hear here and compare it to what we just read in the preamble that came from the book of Exodus. So my eyes aren't that good, so I'm going to try to see this from here. This is the preamble. Quote, when Anu, the sublime, king of the Anunnaki, and Bel, the lord of heaven and earth, who decreed the fate of the land assigned to Marduk, the overruling son of Ea, god of righteousness, dominion over earthly man, and made him great among the Ajiji, they called Babylon by his illustrious name, made it great on earth, and founded an everlasting kingdom in it, whose foundations are laid so solidly as those of heaven and earth. Then Anu and Bel called by name me, Hammurabi, the exalted prince who feared God to bring about the rule of righteousness in the land, to destroy the wicked and the evildoers, so that the strong should not harm the weak, so that I should rule over the black-headed people like Shamash and enlighten the land to further the well-being of mankind. Now that's representative. It goes on, as I say, at some length. And what you notice in the flavor of this preamble is Hammurabi keeps getting more and more attention, you know. He really is using this as a kind of PR piece to sell the Babylonian people not only on the dignity of the law that he is providing to them, but on the very special status that he himself enjoys, that he claims for himself a kind of unique status among the people, and in some ways the preamble is more about Hammurabi than anything else. And I just want you to compare that with the flavor of what we read in the book of Exodus, where you really don't find Moses peddling Moses. I mean, certainly Moses is prominent and gets, you know, rightly so, a fair amount of attention, but the real focus there, of course, is on God himself, who comes down to the majestic power and holiness and glory that's associated with his presence. This is what terrifies the people. This is what gets their attention. This is what gives rise to the warnings that this God might break out against them. There's a very deep sense in which it's God's presence which alarms and fills with awe the people with respect to this law that they're receiving. Really nothing like that at all. That is unique, not only when compared with Hammurabi, but compared with any of the ancient Near Eastern civilization. Something different is in the air when you begin to see the way in which God comes to his people and presents himself to them as the Holy One of Israel. And that theme, the holiness of God, as you're well aware, courses its way through the Old Testament documents and represents something that is just startlingly distinct with respect to the way that we see God presented in the Old Testament scriptures as opposed to what we find in other sources, whether it's Hammurabi or anyone else. Let me give you a couple of examples here of individual laws that come from Hammurabi. I want the lawyers in the room to think about due process here on this first one. Quote, if anyone bring an accusation against a man and the accused go to the river and leap into the river, if he sink in the river, his accuser shall take possession of his house. But if the river prove that the accused is not guilty and he escape unhurt, then he who brought the accusation shall be put to death, while he who leaped into the river shall take possession of the house that had belonged to the accuser. Now, If that's the only thing we had from Hammurabi, I doubt that we'd be talking about him today, you know. But it is interesting that peppered through these 282 regulations, we do find this sort of trial by ordeal that pops up occasionally. And that in itself, I think, gives us pause. Now, some of Hammurabi's laws are quite enlightened, and I think we can be impressed with them. But this is number two on the list. Out of 282, this is number two, where the proof of innocence is based on how you survive jumping into a river. And as I say, due process usually would say there's probably some other things that should go into the test of guilt or innocence than whether you can swim. But nevertheless, that's the second of them. The third is as follows, quote, if anyone bring an accusation of any crime before the elders and does not prove what he has charged, he shall, if it be a capital offense charged, be put to death. Now this is not dissimilar from something we find in Moses. Moses does have a rule that if somebody is trying to invoke the judicial process as a way of essentially committing murder, that is to say, I bring an accusation against somebody claiming that I saw them commit some horrible offense, something that would normally result in the death penalty, and then it comes to light that I myself did that with a kind of malicious intent, knowing better, knowing the person was innocent, but trying to use judicial process to, you know, get rid of that person, then I myself should be subjected to the same penalty that I was attempting to subject that person to. You understand how that works. Moses has a similar rule. Personally, I don't think it's such a bad rule, you know. If somebody knowingly accuses someone knowing that they could, you know, result in that person's death, and to have that come back upon them may not be such a bad concept. So at this point, I'm willing to give Hammurabi credit. That was a pretty good rule, I think, and Moses does have something like that. His fifth law, if a judge try a case, reach a decision, and present his judgment in writing, if later error shall appear in his decision, and it be through his own fault, then he shall pay 12 times the fine set by him in the case, and shall be publicly removed from the judge's bench, and never again shall he sit there to render judgment. This would be the classic bribery situation. Hammurabi does, to his credit, outlaw bribery of judge. He doesn't want judges who are on the take. He wants judges who are detached and disinterested and will render judgments which are fair to the evidence that's provided. Moses has a similar rule, so we'll give Hammurabi credit for that one. This one is the eighth of them. If anyone steal cattle or sheep or an ass or a pig or a goat, if it belonged to a god or to the court, the thief shall pay 30-fold therefore. If they belong to a freed man of the king, he shall pay 10-fold. If the thief has nothing with which to pay, he shall be put to death. Notice a couple of things. First, the gradation of the society. The dignity of the person wronged, to some degree, determines the severity of the punishment. Notice, secondly, that if a person is unable to provide restitution, then they may lose their life in the process. Moses doesn't have anything like that. He does have a rule of restitution. You steal a guy's sheep, you're caught, you have to pay back fourfold. Moses doesn't have anything so severe as if you're so poor you can't pay it back, then you lose your life. Moses would simply have the person work and work off the debt in some kind of restitution provision there. A couple of more just for fun. Hammurabi says, if anyone break a hole into a house to steal, he shall be put to death before that hole and be buried. So you break into someone's house, and for that crime of invading someone else's home, you can be put to death. Moses has a rule like that, but it only applies at night. And in fact, we have a rule like that in American jurisprudence. If someone breaks into your house at night, you are not able to surmise their intent, and you have reasonable, you know, conviction that they may mean you harm, then you can use lethal force at that point. I think you're all aware of that. The rule doesn't apply in the daytime. someone breaks in broad daylight, and there's no indication of their intent to, you know, do you immediate grave bodily harm or death, and you are not justified in taking their life. Here in Hammurabi, the rule is somewhat more severe. Moses had a similar kind of distinction as well. If anyone is committing a robbery and is caught, he shall be put to death. So there's a fair amount of severity in these rules. Generally, the laws of Hammurabi covered commercial transactions, slavery relationships, marriage relationships, and theft. That was the broad, most of the rules covered those subject areas. All right, so there's Hammurabi's code. What I'd like to do is describe in the few minutes we have left, which is not too many, but I've got five, okay, the most significant differences between the Code of Hammurabi on the one hand and what we find in the Law of Moses on the other. The first of these, and one that I think is maybe one of the most interesting, is that Hammurabi's code is in all cases casuistic, whereas Moses provides at the very beginning what's called apodictic law. Casuistic means case law. The formula expression is always if then, if this then that. If a person does this crime, then this is the penalty that will follow. And we saw the examples of that, of course, and that's peppered throughout all of the Code of Hammurabi. Hammurabi never gives us what's called apodictic law, pronouncement law, such as what we find in the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not steal. You see, you never see that. You never see a great kind of ethical maxim that is the guiding principle under which casuistic law must operate. Moses has casuistic law. Hammurabi does not have apodictic law. And that apodictic law does suggest a kind of divine origin. This is as if God is laying down a great rule by which we should conduct our lives. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Thou shalt not commit adultery, and so on. You see these great kind of powerful, solemn pronouncements. Then casuistic law construes it. For the lawyers in the room, this is very similar, almost identical, really, to our distinction between legislative law and case law. We have some law that comes from the legislature, some that comes from the cases. And in a sense, in the Old Testament, you have that kind of distinction. Great pronouncements, as it were, God's legislation, followed by application in particular cases. So that's one difference that I think at least is interesting and worth probably more attention than I've just given it. Moses emphasizes duties to God as the basis for duties to man. Hammurabi doesn't do this. This is important. It may be one of the weightiest differences. For Hammurabi, the reason you obey the law is for the good of the civilization, and the main incentive you have for obeying the law is fear of punishment. There is a kind of might makes right principle that's operating here. Do what you're required to do, or we're going to slap you. Maybe slap you pretty hard. Moses has certainly punishments built into his code, but you realize all along that the real basis for obeying the law is that I have this fundamental prior duty to God. And that's stated in the first four rules of the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. You know, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. You shall not make graven images, and so on. All of that is to root a person's understanding of obedience in their duties to God, their obligations to honor him, and so on. And then out of that flows responsibilities to my neighbor. And that's supposed to be what drives my allegiance to the law and my appreciation of my neighbor's status as one made in the image of God. Moses has no trial by ordeal. You find it peppered through Hammurabi. Some of Hammurabi's rules are pretty good in a due process sense. Some are pretty strange. He has one rule that a thief would have his tongue singed by a red-hot iron. And then the priest examines the blisters on the tongue to determine guilt or innocence. Moses doesn't have that. He doesn't have anything like a trial by ordeal. The closest he comes is a rather strange law that says if a wife is accused of unfaithfulness, she should be brought to the temple or to the tabernacle and made to drink a potion. Well, the potion, if you look at the ingredients, is harmless. It's not a poison or anything like that. And then if the woman is actually guilty, some negative consequences will take place physiologically, and if not, she'll be fine. Personally, I think there's kind of a psychological element behind the whole thing. I don't have time to develop that, but it's certainly not trial by ordeal like jumping into a river or having your tongue singed. I mean, this is really absent from Moses, though it was fairly common in other cultures of the ancient world. The punishments in Hammurabi are generally quite a bit more severe. We usually view Moses as pretty severe. He has 32 separate capital offenses. That's Moses, you know. But Hammurabi is even more severe. So in some ways you'd say vis-a-vis Hammurabi, Moses is a model of liberal leniency in the ancient world, not so much in the modern world. Class distinctions are greatly diminished in Moses. There is a kind of uniformity of application of the law, what we would call equal protection under the law. Even the king is bound by the law under Moses. I heard one commentator say once, the king was the least free person in all of ancient Israel because he was not only obligated to keep the law everyone else was obligated to keep, he also had a special law called the king's law, added rules that bound the king. In Hammurabi, no such thing. There's class distinctions, there's varying degrees of guilt or innocence and severity of punishments based on where you are in the social order. That sort of thing is not so present in Moses. Moses recognizes in a way that Hammurabi really doesn't the intrinsic value of human life. Moses sees people created in the image of God and worthy of respect just by virtue of being a human being. In Hammurabi, those class distinctions are pretty conspicuous. Slaves are not much more than chattel property. The higher you are, the more value you enjoy. That would be another point. I would say the single most important difference is simply the great, awesome dignity that's connected to God in the Old Testament. The gods of the Mesopotamians, including the gods worshipped by Hammurabi, were fraught with human foibles. They were possessed of all kinds of attitudes and behaviors that we would say would be embarrassing for any self-respecting god. They committed adultery. They were seducers. They were liars. They were cheats. They were engaged in all kinds of behaviors that we would say represents anything but holiness. You read Moses' description of the Lord God Almighty, and you see none of that. You see one great unified root of majestic, holy, weighty truth, the one who deserves our worship, and the one who, as he gives us his great law, is giving us something that is for our good and gives us a means of honoring one who is incontestably the most honorable one in all the universe. And to me, that represents maybe the most conspicuous and important difference between Hammurabi on the one hand and Moses.